History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there where you live with the power to amaze you. Stories we're never going to hear if we don't take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what some of the more seasoned members of our communities have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The man that we have the privilege of hearing from today has been on my list for a long, long time. Ray McClure's wife, Bonnie, first suggested I interview him about 15 years ago when I was showcasing World War II vet stories on television. Ray declined then because he felt there were others more deserving of recognition. Over the years, it's come up a few more times, and Bonnie's powers of persuasion finally prevailed. I had the chance to finally meet Ray at the recent opening of a World War II exhibit at the Reedley Museum in Reedley, California. Not too far from where we recorded this interview at the Reedley Airport, one of countless airports that Ray has gotten to know quite well in a long career in aviation. We're going to hear about his missions as a B-17 pilot in World War II, how the life-saving work of the Tuskegee Airmen made a big impact on his perspective. We'll hear about his exploits as a B-26 pilot during the Korean War as well, but we'll start out before he ever thought about flying a plane, and the small school he attended as a boy outside of Shafter, California.
It was called Rio Bravo, and there's a one room for all 8 grades. That's how small it was. I went to school there, and then later on, my mother and dad split up. She moved to San Pedro, and my dad got killed in a car wreck, a single car wreck, between Shafter and Bakersfield, he and another guy. The other guy wasn't hurt. His name was Clarence Rice. He was driving, and the old man was riding. He got blasted there. So I remember him pretty well, but, you know, not all that much because I wasn't that old. And I went to San Pedro High School down south. That's in the harbor there, Los Angeles. Actually, I graduated from high school when I was 16. And I immediately went to work for California Shipyards. That's the one that, it was a big shipyard. They were building these Victory ships. And I was a ship fitter there because I could read a blueprint, not because I could do such a good job. But anyway, just as I started in there pretty good, that's when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. And I took my high school diploma in hand and went racing down to the recruiting station, volunteered. The recruiting guy, he wasn't the brightest star in the sky, but, you know, he accepted it. He accepted the fact that when I told him I was 18, he's okay. And so the next thing I know, I'm on a train to Little Rock, Arkansas, Camp Robinson. They made me a head scout in the rifle team. And let me tell you, I was only there for about 3 or 4 weeks, less than a month. We were on bivouac back in the Ozark Mountains, and I was walking down this little path, swamp on each side, and we'd been back there quite a ways, and on bivouac, you don't have anything, really, you know, no facilities that you don't build and all that. And I'm walking along, and this little puddle-popping two-place airplane came over, and these guys were throwing flower bombs. They were flower bombing us, and one hit me right on the helmet, and out into the swamp I went. And I said to myself, self, that is where I'm going to be, is up there throwing the flower bombs, not down here in the swamp. When we got back to Camp Robinson there at Little Rock, there was a recruiting team there, and they were looking for cannon fodder. I didn't realize it at the time, but their loss rate in the Air Corps, which that was before the Air Force, was 40%, which is awful high. You can figure that there's 10 guys at least in a B-17, And if it went down and they didn't get out, you know, you lost 10 guys in a whack there, and 40% of the airplanes, for instance, you know, 100 goes in and 60 comes out on the raid. That's bad. That's real bad. And anyway, I made that, and they sent me to the University of Buffalo, at Buffalo, New York, to take what's called stanine tests to determine whether you were qualified to be a pilot, navigator, bombardier, or back to the boonies, you know, the bad guys get you. So anyway, I made pilot. I was lucky. We had three deals. You go to primary, that was your first schooling, basic, which was the second, and advanced, which was your third. They sent me to primary, and we were flying steermen, open cockpit steermen. It was quite an experience. Every instructor, they sent us to the civilian fields for primary, but the instructors were military. He was a lieutenant, this guy we had, and he was assigned five cadets. The one thing that really I look back on and have to chuckle that happened to me was I was the first one of the five. They had the Army come in and run a check on how this guy was doing with his cadets. And this guy would ride with you to see how you were doing and if you were passing everything okay. And so I had got through this first initial deal. So our instructor said, well, take one of the airplanes and go out and fly. It's fly around and, you know, play. And so I did. And I got carried away a little bit with all that and was out in the country. And I'm flying around and I suddenly realized that I thought I didn't have enough gas to get back to the field. And I thought, boy, this is going to be a short stint for me. They're going to kick me out, you know, because they're going to frown on me crashing this airplane somewhere. And I'm looking around, and there was this little road, and the only thing on it for miles in either direction was a gas station. So I landed there. I buzzed it first, and a guy came out, so I knew there was someone there. And then I landed on this road and taxied up as close as I could to the station. And I kept the airplane running because it took two or three people to start one little thing. And this guy come out, and his eyeballs are about as big as a pumpkin. So I motioned him over. I kept the airplane just ticking over. I told him, I said, I've only got $5, and I want that much gas. And he says, oh, okay. So he run in the station, and he got some cans. And I don't know how much he put in, but he put in, I told him where to pour it, and he put it in. I waved goodbye, and away I went down the road again and off into the wild blue yonder, you know, thinking, thank you, Lord, and made it back to field fine. And the next thing that happened to me in primary that sort of stands out, this instructor we had, he wanted to be a combat pilot, and here he is instructing, and he isn't just real happy about that. And the way you ride in those things, the instructor was in front, the student in back, and the instructor had a great big round mirror on the trailing edge of the wing, and he'd look at you, you know, he could see you there. And they didn't have radios in those days. They had what was called a Gosport, and it was a funnel. It started out as a funnel on his end, and it's about a half inch tube, rubber tube, and it come back and it plugged into your headset through these little deals on the earphones, you know, and you could hear pretty good with it. And he got to looking at me, you know, and they flipped upside down, and we're driving along upside down, and he says, I think you're sitting a little high in that seat. You better adjust it. And, you know, he'd probably done this 100 times. Well, without thinking, I just pulled the deal, and boy, I shot to the end of that stop out the slipstream, and I thought, I'm going to make my first parachute jump, I think. And but it turned out I didn't. But then I went on the basic. We flew BT-13s, which was a big radial thing, and had a sliding greenhouse that went over the seats, two-place job. And it flew good, and we did pretty good on that, except on my night cross-country, I really, really thought I was going to make my first parachute jump. It was into a three-state deal. We had radios in these airplanes. The meteorologist assured us that there was going to be a beautiful night. No problem, boy. It's just, you know, you're all set. Well, about halfway around, the weather started going bad on me. And I was by myself and, you know, feeling lonesome and talking to God and all this stuff. We went on around, or I did, and I was running low on gas. You know, whenever you start out on something like that, it's all set up on minutes, you know, and you go to the exact minute, you know, if you want to make a turn or the end of the deal, you're supposed to be there if the time says you are. And so I ran into this weather. It was getting pretty murky. I couldn't see too much and everything, and I couldn't see the field. I knew I was in the area, or I thought I was. The time said I was. And I thought, well, I'm going to run out of gas, and I don't want to be down here low if I'm going to leave this bird. So I just decided to start climbing when I saw this great big light and these anti-aircraft lights. I don't know if you've ever seen one or not. They used to have them in front of movies. This before your time, probably, but they used to have them when the war was over. They put them in front of these movies and would wave them back and forth, you know, advertising and everything. Well, I saw this light going, and they had heard me, and they started flashing the light. So, you know, I made it back all right and got in. From there, I went on to multi-engine training.
Well, hold on a second. You said the BT-13 flew pretty good. Everybody else told me that it would vibrate all over the place.
Well, it was called the multi-vibrator, you know, but, you know, I didn't know. It seemed good to me after that steerman. I thought it was a pretty neat airplane, really.
And one more question for you, because, I mean, you told me that it was the flower bomb hitting you that made the light bulb go off. I want to be a pilot. But what about that first time that you were in the cockpit? Because most pilots I know say there was something they felt the first time they were actually up in the air and in control. Did you feel something? Was there something that caught hold of you in that moment?
I don't really remember. At 95, you forget some of those things, you know. But I used to go out to the Long Beach Airport, you know, and scrub airplanes and kick tires and stand fire guard and all that stuff, hoping these guys would give me a ride, you know. And that's where I really got in the air first. But this Piper Cub thing, that was the first Piper Cub I'd been in. And there's an old saying, a Piper Cub is the safest airplane in the world. It will only barely kill you. But anyway, yeah, that I never did feel anything. I really liked it, though. I really liked flying. Have all my life. I used to go months without a day off, just flying, 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 flying. I did a lot of work out the Long Beach Airport just to get a ride. Then I got into the military, and they started teaching me how to fly. And that was pretty neat. When I went to multi-engine, we flew what was called a UC-78, the old bamboo bomber. Seymour, Indiana. But, you know, another deal on that, when I was in basic, it was in Montgomery, Alabama. It was near there. And on the other side of the city was Tuskegee. And, of course, you know, dumb. All of us made fun of those guys because, you know, we'd get on the air and everybody could hear everybody in those days. They didn't have it like now. And we'd go, you know, hello, Tuskegee Tower. This is Army Fo-Fo-Fo, you know, and a bunch of crap like that. And looking back on it, during the war, I regretted that because these guys had, they graduated about the same time I did. They flew a lot of times, we would meet up with our fighter escorts, and it was them. And could those boys fly? And they would stay with you no matter what. They stayed till they were just on fumes, practically, you know, where the other fighter jocks would go home. They would not, boy. They were with you. I would have liked to have had them all the time, but I didn't, unfortunately. But I saw then that I had made a bad mistake. I was only 19, for Pete's sake. That was a kids' war, believe it or not. The kids fought that war, and it was terrible. The oldest guy in my crew was 25, and, you know, there's just one of him. But anyway, I went into this multi-engine stuff, and just before we graduated, about, I would say, probably 2 weeks before we graduated, the CAA, which is now the FAA, came in, and I never did have a pilot's license as such. Never did. The team came in. They wrote us, all of us, all the cadets that was getting ready to graduate, they wrote us out a commercial multi-engine license with an instrument rating. Now, boy, you know, we didn't think much of it at the time, but looking back, that was really something. I got through that all right. And then they sent me to Florida, B-17 transition school. I flew a little anti-submarine patrol a little bit there before I went over to England. and got over there. I got over late, and so it wasn't as bad then. It was bad, but it wasn't like it was at first. Those guys that was over there at first was catching the devil, boy. They, you know, that's where the 40% loss rate was. Yeah. Terrible deal.
Did you get to fly to England, or did you have to go on a ship?
I went on a ship. That shows you what they thought of me. No, they had the airplanes over there already. You know, it was all set. Same thing when I went to Korea. And I could have paddled that devil and made faster time. You know, it was terrible. But anyway, we get over there and we start going. And not too much happened to me in World War II. I just knew I was not going to get hurt or killed. I knew it. Well, that's sort of silly, you know, because next day you get your head blown off. But anyway, a mission consists of early in the morning or whenever they're going to go. The Americans flew day missions and the British flew night. But anyway, on a mission, the flight crews, all of them, all the flight guys, would meet in the ready room. And they would be briefed by the intelligence guys and they would be telling us what to expect and where we were going and all this stuff. How they knew that, I don't know, because those suckers never got in the air. They weren't stupid, you know. But anyway, they would tell us all this stuff. And then the squadron leader would take off, and his second-in-command would take off with him. He took off double ship at a time. And they would circle until all of us got airborne and in formation. Okay, then we'd head out in close formation. A lot of times we picked up other B-17 outfits, you know, we'd all join in together. Because sometimes you had as much as, 40, 50, 60 airplanes going. So we'd be in this tight formation going, and we'd cross the channel and start in. And then our fighter escort would come in and join us. And boy, I always prayed that those red-tailed guys would be there. They flew P-51s. And they had red tails. Then the German fighters would come up. And the German fighters, they didn't give a tinker's damn about our airplanes, our fighters. They wanted us down. They were after the bombers, not the fighters. You know, to them, that was secondary. They could care less. But our boys, it was their job to stop them. They could flat fly, boy, and they would take them on. And they would stay right with you. And then, it was an odd thing, the German fighters would just go home. That meant that the next instant you were going to be in a wall of flak. And, you know, when they left, they didn't want to shoot their own planes down, naturally, so it was going to follow. And the flak and the anti-aircraft guns would start.
And we'll have to pick it up there when we come back. Ray McClure, 95 years old, is our guest today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.